support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Dankman. By almost any account, Bill Porter's life has been a wild ride. The translator and cultural historian, also known as Red Pine, was born into privilege. The son of a bank robber turned influential hotel magnate, Bill went to an elite boarding school and later went AWOL from the army. But that was all just a precursor to what came next. He learned to meditate, moved to a monastery in Taiwan, and for 20 years worked on translating Zen Buddhist poems from Mandarin to English. He then took to the mountains of central China, where he looked for hermits who were believed to no longer exist. Bill, aka Red Pine, found them. His book documenting that journey, Road to Heaven, became a huge success and even appeared on a popular Chinese sitcom akin to Sex and the City. Bill is also one of the foremost Chinese translators who's made numerous texts and sutras accessible for English-speaking audiences. And after documenting the lives of hermits and Zen poets, Bill is now the subject of a documentary himself. Filmmaker Ward Serrell tells Bill's story in the new film Dancing with the Dead. And I'm joined now by Ward and Bill Porter, who are both hailing from Port Townsend. Thank you both for being here, Ward and Bill. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's great to be there and not have to be in Seattle at the same time.
As you can hear, Bill is on Zoom and Ward is here in the studio in Seattle with me. Bill is calling in from Port Townsend. I'm going to start with you, Ward. The topic of, you know, Zen Buddhist poetry, Taoist poetry, ancient Chinese literature and poetry, it's not exactly the most accessible, you know, to a modern audience. But as you say, you use Bill's personal story as kind of an entry point to then bring us these beautiful moments of poetry. How did you think about best displaying that for the audience? Because you use elements of animation and all sorts of different things to really bring that forth.
I think literary films are the hardest to make because you're making a film about something you can't really see. And translation is a mysterious process that's happening inside Bill's brain. So how to make this visual? And then further, the subject that we're talking about, Zen poetry, I wanted it to be more than just words on screen. Can I take people into the feeling that a Zen poem leaves one when reading it? So a way of using animation and music hopefully brought that about more experientially. And then it's got to have some entertainment value in it. So the storyline is, you know, Bill's very adventurous story through life. There's the poetry and the translation. And then the third element going through the film is the search for the hermits. So all together, that's weave those three things together as, you know, on the way to the end of the film.
Bill, Ward talks about your life a lot in this film, and one of the things that sticks out to me is your early experience with mentor figures who sort of guided you into the world of meditation as well as poetry. One mentor was a monk whom you met in New York's Chinatown, and that meeting eventually led you to move to Taiwan and further dive into this world. What was it about that relationship ultimately that led to this major change in your life?
Well, I was at Columbia studying for a PhD in anthropology, but it was funded by the National Defense Language Fellowship to study Chinese. When I was applying to Columbia, I just wanted to study anthropology with, you know, Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict, but I needed some money. And just on a whim, I had to fill in this application thing, choose a language in case they gave me this fellowship. And I just read this book called The Way of Zen by Alan Watson, and it made wonderful sense, and it had all these crazy Chinese characters in it that just amazed me that anybody could read them. And on a whim, I wrote in the word Chinese, so I was stuck with Chinese. I was embarrassed. I felt like a fraud studying Chinese, but it did put me in touch with things like the Chinese community in New York City, and I read more books about Buddhism, and then actually met a monk And I was just impressed with the person this monk had become. You might say his vibes, whatever, the way he manifested himself. He couldn't speak a word of English, except, well, the only word of English he could speak was watermelon. We ate a lot of watermelon, of course, but I was just amazed at what kind of person he was. And I was pretty young then, 26, 27, when I started hanging out with him. I'd spend weekends with him, place outside of New York City. I just liked being in his presence. And then he taught me how to meditate, and I thought, this is so much better than working on a PhD. So after 2 years, I quit, and I never saw him again. Never had a chance to thank him, but just his presence was enough to inspire me.
Ward, inside China, Bill is a celebrity. I mean,
Yeah.
I think it's hard for Westerners to really wrap their heads around Bill's status there. What stands out to you about that and about how they react to Bill?
A few things. One, that the primary fame in China came out from the book The Road to Heaven about the hermit tradition, which to China was a quote rediscovery of that tradition in a way seen by many Chinese as Bill helping them give back part of their own culture. And the second part is the translation that he did of and does of the ancient Chinese poets and that tradition, and how valuable that is in China, all paid off to me in this kind of extraordinary thing where the government of China last year gave him a special book award as having a significant impact on the culture of China. And I think about this. So imagine the U.S. government going to a citizen in, say, Shanghai and say, we want to give you an award to thank you for giving us back a part of our own culture and history. So it's kind of hard to fathom that. And we know in Fort Townsend, this guy that walks, along the beach every day, that guy is one of the most significant figures in contemporary China. And as a filmmaker, that just fascinates me. So I don't know. I mean, Bill says the entourages follow him in China and stuff. So I just, that's fascinating to me.
Is it something about your outsider status, Bill, that helped you as an observer of this cultural treasure that had been lost?
Now, of course, it's always when you're an outsider, you see things that other people in who grow up in that milieu never notice. They're so used to things. And anyway, I went to China to find hermits because I'd been translating the poetry of these hermits, like Cold Mountain and Stonehouse, and I just wondered if people like that really existed. And everybody I talked to said no. In fact, one of the last Chinese person I talked to in Taiwan, who eventually became the president of Taiwan, he was in charge. That was Ma Ying-jeou, and he was in charge of Taiwan mainland relations. And I was after my interview, he said, "This idea of you going to China to find hermits is crazy." He says, "They don't even have any real monks in China, much less hermits." So, and of course, when I went to China, I didn't know where to find hermits. Anybody I asked would just shake their head. Hermits? It was like asking about fairies.
Yeah, where are the unicorns?
Yeah, where are the unicorns? Well, turns out I did run into one monk in Beijing. This is when all the Tiananmen protests were going on too. So Beijing was having a citywide celebration by the people of the city. It was a crazy time, May of 1989. Anyway, I met this monk, and he said, "Well, I think I heard there's still some hermits in the Zhongnan Mountains." And I didn't even know where the Zhongnan Mountains were. And of course, I thought in Chinese, when you say mountain, you don't know if it's one mountain or a whole range of mountains. And the Zhongnan Mountains are this huge range of mountains, several hundred kilometers east-west, about 100 kilometers north-south. So it's a big range of mountains, and it's a set of mountains that are directly south, about 20 kilometers south of the modern city of Xi'an, which was in ancient times Chang'an and was the capital of about nine different dynasties. So these mountains were really close to the capital, and that's where people would go to for solitude, for different purposes. Some people just to get away from things for a while, but the real hermits went there for spiritual transcendence, to achieve something. that they needed solitude to achieve what they were looking for. One of which is, one of the things for which is their own voice. And you can always tell somebody who's teaching from their heart and somebody who's teaching from a book or what their teacher told them. And if you go through the biographies of modern Chinese masters, whether Taoist or Buddhist, you cannot find a single person. You can't find one person who was not a hermit. It's where people, I tell people, it's sort of where you get your PhD. You have to have an undergraduate degree, obviously, to go to such a place. You never last one winter, but these people are going there to find something, to feel, to put all their academic and book learning away and just be with themselves, see what it all amounts to.
I'm speaking with Bill Porter, also known as Red Pine, who is a world-famous translator of Chinese Zen Buddhist poetry, Chinese texts, and Taoist poetry, and also Ward Serrell, who is the director of the new film about Bill, Dancing with the Dead. And they're both based in Port Townsend. Bill, was there a moment after the publication of your book about these and finding these hermits, that you knew it was really making an impact in China? Was there a moment when you realized how famous this text had become?
Well, it certainly didn't become famous in America. It was published in America in 1993, and of course, those kind of books, not many Chinese read them, and they don't often make their way to China. So it hadn't made any, and it never made any impact at all in America. Eventually, I gave a copy to the monk. I found the monk who had told me where he thought hermits were, and I gave him a copy of it, this Master Jinghui. And he gave that copy to one of his disciples who knew English, and she translated that book. And I think it came out around 03, something like that. It was a small press, and it didn't amount to anything. And then about 4 or 5 years later, another press picked it up. And so that would have been about, oh, maybe 2010, maybe something like that, 2009. This other press was a bigger press and started promoting it, and it changed my life because of the income. I'd been on food stamps for 18 years, having come back to America for 18 years. Without food stamps, I wouldn't have had enough for me and my kids to eat. But once the Chinese started buying that book, well, now they've sold over 2 million copies of that book. I was in the movie, I say, I'm drinking $15 wine now and $80 bourbon.
I like to say too that, it, in a way, you've become the, to some extent, China's Jack Kerouac. And I say that in the sense of how it's some of his books, especially Dharma Bums, helped inspire younger people in the 60s, 70s to go into the hills. Your book and books have done the same in China to some degree of people going back into the mountains for enlightenment. Yes?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, not just that, but the other books as well. I know the Hermit book has been my big seller, but my book Zen Baggage has already sold over 1 million, where I interview Zen masters in monasteries and Zen nuns too. And also another million seller is Finding Them Gone, where I go to the graves of the 40 greatest poets and I read them their poetry in Chinese, and I read them my translations of their poetry, and I pour bourbon whiskey on their graves and tell little stories about them. And the people in the Central Committee of the Communist Party found out about that book, and that's why they gave me this prize, the highest prize they give to Westerners in China. That amazed me more than anything, that because hermits are the most respected people in China. That it's hard, it sounds weird just to say that. And even the members of the Communist Party in China hold them in high esteem. And every hermit is living illegally on government land, and nobody touches them. Although now what's happening is because of my book, a lot of rich people are going into the mountains and building their own fancy huts. And but when they do, the government then when you fi when the government finds out about this, they tear them down because the mountains are for hermits and wild animals.
But it sounds like you're, renewing attention on this. It's had unforeseen repercussions too, right? I mean, there's a kind of a sense of like a fear of gentrification, because of the spotlight that you have brought to this practice again. Is there like a mixed feeling that you have about that?
Oh, every once in a while, I run into a young hermit who suggests I should have never written that book. But by and large, like as I said before, if anybody's a phony hermit, word gets out. So there aren't hermits everywhere in China. There are certain mountains in China, the Zhongnan Mountains being the biggest center of all. When people come up to the mountain and build something, everybody knows what's going on, and word gets out to the government, the Buddhist Association or the Taoist Association, and they tear down their houses. So the phonies generally get weeded out. But the main thing is this book and the notoriety that I've brought to this tradition, reminding Chinese this is their tradition, has. In just in the Zhongnan Mountains alone, it has tripled the hermit population. Lots more hermits, and about 60 to 70% of all the hermits are women. And now they're professionals, dropouts from Beijing University, people with really great high levels of education are becoming hermits. The people I interviewed were not highly educated. They were maybe they could read Buddhist sutras, Taoist texts, but they had never. No, I never met anybody who'd gone to a university. So, there. What is happening though that has caused some problems in the mountains isn't my book. It's the fact that the Chinese are starting to spend more time outside of cities in the mountains. Hiking clubs, for example. So a lot of hermits have to put signs out on the trail, the hermit is not in.
Yeah, I'm a hermit for a reason. I'm not interested in hanging out with the hikers.
I have something just to add to
yeah,
the hermit issue, and that is when we hear hermits in the West, it's like, oh, somebody who's running away from society. And one of the things that comes through in the film is that this is a tradition that's 5,000 plus years old that's revered there. And the idea is that these people are leaving society to go into the hills to find some, as Bill says, their own voice, enlightenment, and then come back down to be in service to society. We don't have such a thing, and I
Yeah,
found that
hermit is sort of a
fascinating.
nefarious word in the US in some ways. I mean, you think things like the Unabomber or, people who drop out because they're dangerous, but these are people who actually want to serve society. And your film, I think, explores that really beautifully. You've worked in these areas of people, and Bill, I hope you'll excuse me for saying this, but people are who are pretty obsessive about certain
Thank you.
things. Bill has a single-minded focus in his professional life, at least from what we see, on this Chinese literature, Chinese poetry. You've worked before with bow makers in Port Townsend. What is it about people who are a little obsessed
That's
that
great.
inspires you?
I like to hear that because even my first film, Bill reminds me somewhat of another Bill Wrestler from The Heart of the Game here in Seattle. And I think the through line is when I say that I look for a character to take me into story, it is that thing which is a passionate intensity to do something odd, whether it coaches a girl's basketball team or, translate Chinese poetry or make, cello bows. But people who are absolutely single-mindedly devoted to that purpose, and that brings a lot with it. Then I look for somebody who doesn't necessarily live within the lines, and that starts to bring in the interesting story character as you find out with Bill. Sorry to talk about you as a character, but relative to a film, it was wonderful to have Bill as a person to portray, and that he's a great storyteller allowed me to incorporate ways to bring those stories alive. So that's what brings me back to Bill Ressler. Bill Ressler was a great storyteller, as is Bill Porter.
What do you feel like you learned from Bill personally during the process of making the film?
The first thing I'd say is, to this moment now, given everything we went through in the last 4 years, I find Bill a continuity. And what I mean by that is all the ups and downs that I saw in his personal life, public life, and stuff that would go wrong, he stays steady. And I'd say that he's a serious practitioner of what he's talking about in terms of the Zen practice, not one to talk about it as one shouldn't if one knows what they're doing, you know. I shouldn't talk about Zen. But that thing, I remember when he lost his cell phone and his passport on a beach in Taiwan after we had been there with Kimbo, an indigenous Taiwanese singing the sun into the day. And we got back to the hotel and Bill had lost his cell phone and passport. It was gone. And that's a pretty big deal when you're overseas. And I watched him respond to that, and I actually went up and joked with him and said, you know, Stonehouse would be proud of you right now because you've lost your identity, you know, and he laughed. And so that, I just think there's a quality that to me underlies a lifetime of Dharma work and devotion to the finding that place inside that allows one to be steady.
Bill, I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this, but is there a favorite poem or a poem you've worked on recently that you have at hand that you might be able to leave us with as this conversation closes?
I've been working on the poems of a very special poet named Sin Chi Ji, who lived about 900 years ago. The Chinese have the cuckoo is a common bird in China, and when it sounds its cry in Chinese, the Chinese think it's saying, better go home, better go home. And this is a poem that he wrote. Sin Chi Ji wrote this in the year 1161. And incidentally, Sin Chi Ji was living in exile. The nomadic tribe had taken over northern China. The court had to flee south of the Yangtze, and so he was living in exile. This is called Cherry Blossoms on Fire. Cherry blossoms on fire, lighting a whole trellis of snow-white raspberry flowers. Spring at its best, bamboo shoots breaking through purple moss-covered slopes. Swallows leading chicks to test their wings, zigzagging orioles courting new friends. Since spring was leaving, I asked if it could take my sorrows too, undo the thousand knots in my heart. I looked out from a tower at the ridges of newly green hills toward my home beyond the mist. About my lifelong regrets, who could I tell? Butterflies can't carry a dream that far. Beneath the late night moon, a cuckoo called. I listened to its cries in bed, urging me to go home, but I can't go home.
That's Bill Porter, also known as Red Pine. And I was also joined in this conversation by Ward Serrell, who's the director of a new documentary about Bill and his work and his life. It's called Dancing with the Dead. And it will premiere in Seattle at SIFF Egyptian Theater on Sunday, April 21st at 2 p.m. There will also be a performance by Spring Chang and a Q&A with 10,000 Things podcast host Shinyi Pai. And we'll have information about that event on our website, kuow.org/soundside. Thank you both very much for being here and for the conversation. I really enjoyed it and really appreciated your time.
Thank you. It was a kick.
Well, thanks a lot, Libby.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at kuow.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.